From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, probing candidates' claims in the Senate race.
It's tough to, you know, start accusing one person of one thing without looking at yourself, just to be fair. And there's not a lot of that going on.
Michigan's Liberian community worries as Ebola threatens their loved ones.
In March, we started at 49 cases. By August, it was 3,500. By January, we're talking about 1.4 million.
Why Michigan's Attorney General was thinking about maiden names 40 years ago.
You know, this sounds like nothing that would raise an eyebrow these days, but that was a fairly momentous development back then.
And millennials say no to credit cards.
You're not going to develop any credit history if you've never had any credit.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. A patient in isolation at a Dallas hospital has the Ebola virus. It's the first case of Ebola diagnosed here in the U.S. Here in Michigan, the Liberian and West African communities are feeling this crisis in a very personal way.
In March, we started at 49 cases. By August, it was 3,500. By January, we're talking about 1.4 million.
I'm Cynthia Canty. What are we missing when we talk about Ebola? That story and more today on Stateside. But first, the race to fill Carl Levin's seat in the U.S. Senate is one of the most hotly contested in the country. The sheer number of campaign ads attest to that. Democrat Gary Peters and Republican Terry Lynn Land volleying charges and countercharges at each other. Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler has been truth-squatting the Peters and Land campaign ads. Todd, let's begin with your story in today's Free Press, trying to figure out which candidate did or did not support the auto bailout. Who's saying what about whom?
Well, I don't think there's much question that Congressman Peters supported the bailout. I mean, he's been, you know, consistent throughout. The real question is regarding former Secretary of State Land and what her position on it is, because up until last week, we had never heard her say outright that she was supportive of it. And quite frankly, coming this late, that raises some questions. The Peters campaign for some time had been saying that she wasn't supportive of it, and while she was making sort of political answers, which sort of seemed to obscure where her position was on it, last week she finally said that she did support it, and that, you know, that came as something of a shock for a lot of us.
You kind of drilled down into past statements from Terry Lynn Land, and what did you find?
Well, what we had found is that while we couldn't find a lot of statements that she had made on the auto bailout, either the 2008 legislation that never passed that would have rescued GM, Chrysler, and Ford, or the Bush, then Obama rescue efforts themselves. You know, in 2009, when she was thinking about running for governor, she sort of left open the question about whether or not any money, or how much money, if any, should be used from the taxpayers to support these companies. And then in 2012, when she was a member of the Republican National Committee, she, you know, made mention of the fact that she was with Mitt Romney in his position. Now, Governor Romney, then the Republican nominee for president, you know, he himself had sort of a nuanced view of the bailout. He said he was for the sort of structured bankruptcy that the Obama administration put forth for GM and Chrysler, but he was against public financing. And there were a lot of people who said without public financing, it never would have worked. The credit markets weren't there to support it. And so everybody sort of took it to time, and from there on, that was Secretary Land's position.
Hmm. And the campaign told you her previous comments were on the process of coming to terms on a bailout, not any personal objection to the final comment. What does that mean, do you think?
Right. Well, listen, I will say that the Congressman Peters campaign goes farther on this than I would, per se. They say that Secretary Land is lying on this, that she was against it, and now she's for it. You know, I can't say that. And I don't think that from the record can necessarily say that. But what the record does say is that at no point has she come out and said before, I'm for it. And she's been asked. She's been asked on numerous occasions whether or not she was supportive of the bailout that most people credit with saving GM and Chrysler. And she has never said that she was. We've asked the campaign, has she ever said this before? We can't get, you know, proof of some kind of answer. What they're saying now is that, you know, she might have disagreed with some of the, you know, the ins and the outs, but that in the end she would have gone along with the final product if it was the only thing there. She's had numerous occasions over the last 6 years to say that.
So Truth Squad, is either side being untruthful with what they're saying?
Well, I think that really what it gets down to is, whereas we wouldn't say necessarily that she's a liar. That's a pretty harsh charge to make against somebody per se. What we can say is that the fact that she's waited this long and this late in the game to say outright that she was supportive of the Obama bailout, you know, smacks of political opportunism, and that's just a fact.
Now, over to the complicated issue of campaign finances. You've got Gary Peters claiming that Terry Lynn Land won't answer questions about the $2.9 million donation she made to her own campaign, and Free Press Digging found she didn't have those kinds of assets. You have Terry Lynn Land accusing Peters of owning shares in Total SA, a French oil company linked to bribing Iranian officials. And then you've got each side accusing the other of being a creature of Wall Street. As you dug in, what did you find with all of these questions?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of misdirection on both sides when you get into this this subject. I mean, is it fair to question Congressman Peters' ownership of Total SA, the French oil company, its U.S. subsidiary, you know, at a time when he and his allies have criticized other oil companies for making a product, Petcoke, that Total SA makes? It is. It's absolutely fair to bring that up and for people to make up their own minds. Now, I should say, Peters has no controlling interest in Total SA, and lots of people own oil stocks. Where the Land campaign sort of goes too far on that is, you know, they start talking about this Iranian bribery issue. And, yeah, it's true. Total SA had to pay a $400 million fine to settle some charges of bribing Iranian officials for access to oil fields last year under the Corrupt Practices Act. But there are lots of companies, GE and IBM and Johnson & Johnson, that lots of people own, including, you know, the Lands and their mutual funds have shares of that, that have also been fined under the same act for many of the same kind of practices. So, you know, owning stocks and having mutual funds and having shares of things and having a balanced portfolio is really just, it's tough to, you know, start accusing one person of one thing without looking at yourself, just to be fair. And there's not a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. Now, when you start talking about the $2.9 million that Secretary Land self-funded herself up to now.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we agree she should really come clean as to where that money came from, because according to her own public disclosure reports, there is not that money under her control that she could have used to put that into her own campaign. Now, she says it comes from a joint account, which sort of suggests that her husband, who, you know, makes a lot of money off of the family real estate business, maybe moved it in there and then she tapped it. But, you know, there are limits on what spouses are supposed to contribute. And, you know, there's a legal question one way or another whether that's allowable. But why not just make it clean? There's no one saying that, you know, if that's how it happened, that maybe she's on the up and up. But everyone would stop asking the question if she would just say it came from here. But I think they very much want to keep the family real estate company away from the campaign.
Bottom line, what's the message to those of us who are watching these campaign ads, Todd?
The message is, and this goes for whichever side you're looking at, don't believe everything you hear. When you see on the screen those little citations, if you can, go read them. Read stuff that try to fact check these materials. Dig in as much as you can, because often, if not even usually, the truth really lies somewhere beyond what you're being presented in these campaign ads.
Detroit Free Press Washington reporter Todd Spangler. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
And you can ask Republican candidate Terry Lynn Land your questions Friday morning. The former Secretary of State will join Michigan Radio for a Michigan Calling election special. That's Friday morning at 9. More details are at MichiganRadio.org or on the Facebook page Michigan Calling. And while you're there, you can listen back to the Michigan Calling program that Congressman Peters appeared on in August. A state attorney general is called on to render opinions on many issues. 40 years ago this week, Michigan Attorney General Frank Kelly issued an opinion that has resonated throughout the years about women and their maiden names. Michigan Radio political commentator Jack Lessenberry is here with us. Jack, just what was the issue that led to this opinion?
Well, it's a question from the State Board of Nursing. Some of the nursing graduates, who are overwhelmingly female, I believe they still are, wanted to use their maiden names on their licenses without formally changing their name, and so the State Board asked if that was all right. And Kelly, in his opinion, said that not only was that okay, that married women could retain their maiden names. This was exactly 40 years ago. About 6 years later, he said it was all right also if a husband getting married wanted to take his wife's surname. So, you know, this sounds like nothing that would raise an eyebrow these days, but that was a fairly momentous development back then.
And, I wondered, it was pretty groundbreaking for 1974. Was there any kind of reaction to this opinion?
I don't recall any negative reaction at all. I think that it was just seen as an idea whose time had come. I think a lot of women did that anyway, and it wasn't really... The question wasn't really sparked by a huge sort of feminist outpouring. It was just merely a procedural thing by the State Board of Nursing, but it helped them. I think it was one more step further legitimizing women. Of course, a lot of women these days retain their maiden name after marriage or hyphenate their name, and I've even known some men who did in fact take their wife's surname because they liked it better. But you have to remember that in Michigan, when the Attorney General issues an opinion, it has the force of law unless it's overturned by legislative action or the courts. And Attorney General Kelly, who I know quite well, issued probably more of these opinions than anybody else. Not only throughout his career, he served as Attorney General longer than anybody else, but also on an annual basis. He'd issue 100 or more of these a year, and a lot of them still have the force of law.
He truly shaped life in Michigan.
Well, he certainly did from a legal standpoint.
Yes, indeed. And so as I think about it, instead of me becoming Cynthia Canty in 1976, my husband could have been Sean Bruce, which is a strange thought.
Well, there's all sorts of permutations. Of course, some people make up names now when they get married or just change their names and hyphenate them. And so there's an endless variety, but this was sort of one more step on the road to allowing people to do whatever they wanted to as far as calling themselves.
Michigan Radio political commentator Jack Lessenberry. As always, thanks so much, Jack.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Africa's Ebola epidemic is truly chilling. The death toll has passed 3,000 and continues to rise. Raising alarms in this country, yesterday the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed that a patient in Dallas, Texas, who flew from Liberia to visit family in the U.S., has been confirmed as having Ebola. Meanwhile, affected countries in the middle of the Ebola epidemic are struggling to find doctors and the resources needed to care for the sick. Here in Michigan, the Liberian and West African communities are feeling this crisis on a very personal way. Harolyn Baker is an epidemiologist who's based in Detroit. Thank you for being here, Harolyn.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Martha Toe is the chairperson of the Liberian Association of Michigan. Welcome, Martha.
Thanks for having us.
Harolyn, I saw that just last week alone, there were 113 new cases of Ebola reported in Liberia in only one 24-hour period. Is this the worst health crisis Liberia has ever faced?
This is correct. This is the worst epidemic that Liberia has ever faced. In the 80s, we did have an issue with the Lassa fever, which took us 10 years to clear. But at the rate that Ebola is increasing, which is five times each month the previous case, we think that if this is not controlled, this can impact millions and millions of people.
And you are an epidemiologist, and so you're in the business of looking and predicting health trends. What do you think are the factors that are leading to such an incredible outbreak, the worst ever? Because we've seen Ebola kind of pop up and then go away and then pop up again and settle down again. Mm-hmm. What has led this to become so horrendous?
Well, I think with Liberia, it starts with the health infrastructure. You are dealing with a country in which there are limited hospitals. There are 51 physicians in the entire country. And in Monrovia alone, there's 1.4 million people living in such a small area. So that is the foundation in which you're talking about. Just for everyday care, such as malaria, that can be detrimental. And then couple that with an outbreak like this of this caliber, where you already have a poor infrastructure to begin with. It's just a setup for catastrophe, which is actually occurring right now.
Martha, give us an idea of the size of Liberia compared to, is it akin to Michigan? Can you give us a sense of the size?
Size of Texas.
And how many doctors?
51.
51 doctors.
In the entire country.
Yes. In the whole country. What are you hearing from people at home?
I still have family. About 80% of my family are still there. So when we call our families, they're very devastated. They pretty much, some of them sound like they have given up on life. We, as family in the States, have to just comfort them. Liberians are really, we're God-fearing people. We worship, believe in God. So when I speak to my family, what I tell them that God is going to be in control, this is just something that's going to pass. So once we convey that to them, that brings comfort to them.
Is your family in the city or are they more on the outskirts?
Oh, they're spread out.
They're spread all over. And is the disease being felt outside of the cities? Is it across the country?
Yes, it is.
That has to be very, very hard for you. Here you are in Michigan and you're on the phone with your loved ones who are on the front lines of one of the worst health disasters the world's ever known.
Yes. When it first started, we feel very helpless because, as you know, Liberia, there's no direct flight that can go there directly. And it takes about 24 hours pretty much to get on a plane and go in transit. So it's not like you're going to South Michigan or going North Michigan that you can just get in the car and drive and get there. So that's the hardest part because all we can do is talk to them on the phone and try to comfort them on the telephone. But it's not like you can reach and really help.
Now, neither of you, luckily, I was just hearing, have had loved ones or friends directly affected by Ebola, right?
No, luckily. But at the rate this is going, the CDC estimated about 1.4 million cases by January without increased intervention. We cannot, say that will hold true at the rate this disease is going right now.
And the global response, we hear a lot of talk from countries all around the world to the Ebola epidemic and promises. But I did see the head of Doctors Without Borders saying the promised surge has not yet delivered. Mm-hmm. What are the main needs right now?
The main needs, I would say, are supportive services. And that is why with Liberia, the fatality rate is between 70 to 90%. So basic IV, food. You have, again, when I talked about infrastructure, where poverty is large in part, you have people who have poor nutrition. So with Ebola, the first thing is you have to respond very early. So that means you have to go to the hospital. So when you have transportation as an issue and you have very limited clinics, there's about 3 hospitals in the entire city, and there's no means of treating it. So all of the cases that we've been studying of the success are people who have caught the disease very early, the first day. They have received supportive services such as pain meds. They've received the fluids that they needed, and they were quarantined and isolated in the place where they received the nutrition. That would probably be 1%. At the beginning of this, only 10% of the cases were actually seeking support. Others, because the disease mimics so much, such as malaria, they will misdiagnose as malaria or misdiagnose malaria patients as Ebola. And then sometimes you quarantine both patients in the same room, in the same facility and site. Therefore, the spread of disease, those without Ebola and Ebola were quarantined together. So that is sort of the surface of why this disease spread in Liberia at the rate it did compared to other African countries.
And the caregivers wind up becoming ill.
And just to add to that, also, families that have malaria, like she's saying, they would take them and put them with the Ebola patients. So because of that, a lot of the families are very afraid when they have a headache or if they have any symptoms or diarrhea or anything like that, they will not call to get help, because they are afraid that they're going to take them and put them with the Ebola patients. So people are staying home with their families, and the disease is spreading. So if one family have it, the rest of the people are going to have the disease as well.
I'm talking with Martha Toe, who's the chairperson of the Liberian Association of Michigan, and she's joined by Harolyn Baker, who's an epidemiologist. She's based in Detroit, representing the Liberian community here in Michigan, and you're trying to rally support and help. What do you want Americans to understand, Martha, about Ebola and about your country?
We want America to understand that our country is a sister country to the United States. It's one of African oldest countries.
I think we want to bring awareness to this issue. There's so much going on in the world right now. And sometimes when a problem is not in your backyard, it's easy to ignore. But the thing with Ebola, at the rate it's going, we did see some cases where, with the first case that went to Nigeria, that was through a plane ride. The second case to Senegal, in which she caught, that was from traveling. So we want to bring the awareness that, you know, at the rate this is going, I mean, we're talking about five times each month. In March, we started at 49 cases. By August, it was 3,500. By today, the CDC is reporting it's going to be about 21 cases. By January, we're talking about 1.4 million.
You said 21 cases.
21,000 cases. And 1.4 million. So at the rate it's going, we want to take precaution right now. What we're asking the community to do is just to provide any support that they can provide. Right now, there's a lot of supplies going to Liberia, but given the infrastructural issues with Liberia, the ports are backed up. And so there's financial need as well. So with this, you have hospitals that are closed because of the issue. So where do people go to get prenatal care, safety net care? You know, women are still having babies. Children still need the care. So to support, to also provide financial support for food, nutritional support as well. The need is great. And wherever people can find in which they can connect and support, the country needs any support that the international community can provide them.
And I'm sure they desperately need medical professionals to come and help, because I know that there have been courageous people, doctors and nurses and support staff on the front lines who have actually caught Ebola and died trying to fight this battle. How can people help? What would be some of the best ways? I did see your phone number was actually listed in the newspaper story about this. What would be a good way for people to be able to, who want to help, to be able to do so?
Well, we have a GoFundMe page. So people are donating financial support. And then we also take in donations of items that we also had in the newspaper.
Give us an idea of the items you
Gloves,
need.
Gloves, gowns, medical supplies, Clorox.
Bleach.
Bleach, yeah.
Antibacterial soap,
anything
sanitation,
that you think.
So. What are your biggest fears, Harolyn, as far as what could be happening in Liberia and in West Africa and then beyond?
My biggest fear is already happening now. I think this epidemic has gone far beyond what we've expected already. The first 100 cases were enough. The first 5 cases were enough. And now we're talking about 6,000 and almost 21,000 cases by today. So I think the continued growth of this and the spreading of this to other countries is the biggest fear. And also, children are not in schools right now. They've been out of school for almost 6 months and not going back. And if you know anything about Liberia, which has got a 14-year civil war, to keep children out of school for a full year, we don't know what sort of impact that is having on them as well. And then reintegration. So once someone is cured from this, how do you reintegrate them into their communities in which people are not fearful that they will harm them? So there's a holistic, comprehensive approach, strategy that needs to be thought about to sort of alleviate us from the country from this issue moving forward.
It sounds, Martha, to like a very, very long tunnel, and I don't think you're seeing a light at the end of that tunnel at this point, are you?
It's fun, but yes, I don't see a light.
Is it hard to keep faith?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. But we all know with God, anything is possible. So I know, like Harolyn said, we've been through 14 years of war, and we're able to get out of that. God can take care of Ebola, and I know he will.
But if you get some help from people around the world, like mm-hmm. right here in Michigan, that'll all be very good.
That would be perfect, yes.
We have contact information for the Liberian Association of Michigan and Martha and the funding page up on our website. Just go to michiganradio.org and you can click on the link that says Stateside. Martha Toe and Harolyn Baker, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with
us
today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
University of Michigan researchers believe the water you had this morning in your coffee or that you're drinking right now could be older than the sun. Ilse Cleaves is an astronomy PhD student. Ilse, you and your fellow researchers think that 30 to 50% of our water is actually older than the sun in the solar system?
Right. So the water in the solar system has this fingerprint where it has a slight excess of heavy water relative to light water.
Now, remind us again, because for some of us, it's been a while since we took physics or chemistry. Heavy water and light water differences are?
Heavy water has a deuterium atom. So light water is H2O and heavy water is HDO. So deuterium, the D in that HDO is deuterium. And deuterium is just like a hydrogen atom, but it has an extra neutron, which makes it heavier.
Okay. So how does that all fit?
These enrichments of heavy water relative to light water, they occur naturally in interstellar space. So throughout the universe, there's sort of a constant number of deuterium relative to hydrogen atoms that was set in the Big Bang. And it's constant throughout. Now, the enrichment we have indicates that we have a couple extra deuterium atoms in our water and the water in comets and many sources throughout the solar system. Where did that come from? Well, these enrichments occur naturally in the coldest environments in interstellar space, only tens of Kelvin above absolute zero. At these temperatures, it's so cold that the water can feel the difference between being heavy and being cold. And there's a slight preference to it being in this heavier state. And so that already tells us something interesting. The water in the solar system formed in a very, very cold environment.
The water that we have on Earth today.
Yes, or at least 50% of it.
50% of it.
Yeah.
And this really is a more important realization than just, mm-hmm. oh, cool, the water here in my bottle could be older than the sun. What are the deeper implications of what you found?
Based on these findings, the kind of water we have, the only place it could have come from was this very cold gas that predates the sun. Now, the implications of that are that if our sun's formation and if the formation of the planets was typical, water should be a pretty common ingredient in all planet formation.
Does it tell us that if we're pursuing travel to other planets and we move beyond, man eventually gets beyond, that does that tell us that water could be there?
Yeah, it at least gives there's a higher chance of water being there. And I think, well, there was the recent direct detection of water in the atmosphere of a Neptune analog. So water seems to be this common ingredient during the formation of planets. Now, stepping back a little bit, of course, where the Earth formed, its current location from the sun is actually pretty hot on the scales of the solar system. And it's thought that the Earth actually formed dry, without water to start with. And so that water is also, where did that come from? And so there's a couple of theories. Some folks say it's these asteroids delivered water later, or comets. But in this work, we were specifically trying to understand, where did the water in comets come from? There's a whole lot of factors that have to come together to make a water-rich planet, but it happened here.
And it's stunning. I mean, we're talking about, you're kind of digging into things that happened, 4.5 billion or more years ago?
Right. It's, I mean, relatively young in terms of the age of the universe, but it's older than anything we interact with, you know, on a daily basis. It's always exciting to find that link between something like water and our interstellar origins.
The very, very beginning of it all.
Right, exactly.
What led you to astronomy?
I actually became interested in astronomy at a very young age, actually fifth grade. Had a lot of excellent teachers who just opened my eyes to the wonders of astronomy. We had an amazing field trip out to a barrier island in Georgia, and there was an astronomy unit on the beach at night. And it was just this really just beautiful, amazing field trip that got me really excited about learning about stars.
What are you hoping that you'll accomplish, that you might be able to accomplish in your chosen career? You're a PhD student, so you're going to get that doctorate and go on to a life working in astronomy. What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, finding these kinds of links. I enjoy these sort of astrobiological links, trying to find our place in the universe and to understand, you know, how these ingredients came together to form Earth and to form our entire planetary system. I'm interested in understanding these young planetary systems, we call them protoplanetary disks. This is the birth environment of the planets. And so we can observe these in space using very sensitive telescopes, and we can watch planet formation happening in front of our eyes. So I hope to, you know, continue along these lines and
understanding what's happening out there helps you understand what happened here.
Exactly.
Including our water, which, as you discovered, could be 30 to 50% older. Of it could be older than the sun in the solar system. Ilse Cleaves is an astronomy PhD student at the University of Michigan. Their research is published in the current issue of Science, so you could read more about that. So we will all kind of look at our water bottles with new respect. Thanks so much, Ilse.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent report from Bankrate.com finds millennials are not embracing credit cards the way their parents or older siblings have. 63% of millennials do not have a credit card. Detroit News personal finance columnist Brian O'Connor is with us. Brian, just why aren't the 18 to 29-year-olds seeking out credit cards?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors involved in this. And the first one could very well be that they can't get them. Between the debt load that a lot of these folks have from college loans and stricter credit card rules that are designed to keep a lot of college kids from getting a credit card when they don't have a way to pay it, that's probably restricting a lot of applications for credit cards right there. This is one of the things that personal finance experts really hated, and that was that credit card companies would sign up with colleges, you know, at tables on campuses, signing kids up with a credit card, you know, with a promotional T-shirt or a Frisbee on the first day of the classes, and they didn't really care whether the kids could pay their bills. They didn't even care if they were still minors in some cases. They'd give a card to a 17-year-old freshman knowing that their parents would bail them out.
And I'll give you a story right now. This is exactly what jumped in my mind when I knew we were going to have this conversation. From the 90s,
uh-huh.
A close friend, they bought a Michigan Education Trust so their son could graduate from college debt-free, but he signed up for more than one credit card on his campus and got the credit card and the Frisbee and the T-shirt, racked up a shocking credit card balance. So they had to bail him out of that when he graduated. He was not debt-free. So, you know, you see that, and as a parent, you think, well, then I don't want my child to have a credit card.
Right. And the bigger problem with that was two things, was the fact that the kid didn't have a way to pay. He didn't have any income of his own. And the assumption was, even when it's not legal to give, you know, it's not legal to enforce the debt if the kid was 17 years old when he signed up for the card, parents didn't want their children trying to find jobs and rent apartments with these, you know, terrible credit histories that would result. And even worse was that the colleges were often getting, if it was a college-branded card, the college was getting a kickback on it.
Yeah.
You know, so you'd go to, you know, the University of Southwest Northeast, you know,
sure.
Virginia Technical Institute, and it'd have the Fighting Wombats on it, and they were getting money. So the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which a whole bunch of people hate for all the wrong reasons, this is one of the things that they've cracked down on. So that's one thing. So it's harder for kids to get credit cards. It's harder for them to qualify because they probably don't have jobs, so there's no income, no card. They have a whole bunch of debt, so they have a really bad debt situation. And another thing is that a lot of millennials really don't want to use credit, maybe because they do have all those college loans that they're paying off, maybe because they don't have a steady income. But I think it's also partly because there's just been that kind of generational shift since the Great Recession, where a lot of them are using debit cards, so they have access, you know, to a bank and to the nation's financial system, and they're just choosing, you know, not to use credit at this point, which you can't really fault them for.
You can't, but then I know, back to friends again, another friend's son had no credit card through school, no debt, but then he tried to buy a house, and he couldn't do a single thing without getting mom and dad on board. So it seems to me there's probably a balance that needs to be struck with young people and credit.
Right. You put your finger on the one downside to all this kind of pay-as-you-go strategy, which is that you're not going to develop any credit history if you've never had any credit. One of the ways around that, and I can remember when I graduated college, basically everybody got an American Express, you know, application in their mailbox. So there was that attempt to sign people up many years ago. One way around that is that parents can add their children to their card as an authorized signer, which means the credit will be reported in the kid's name. Now, it's different than just getting a second card, you know, for little Junior and Missy.
Okay.
You have to sort of add them to the account. But as an authorized signer, they can't really go in and change it. They can't go ask for a credit limit increase or something like that. That gets some credit history, and that also means that you'll be able to go online and see, or look at your statement and see, if they are running amok, you know, off in East Lansing or Ann Arbor or something like that.
So you can watch what they're doing.
Card.
But as an authorized signer, then they are building a track record.
they are getting some credit too. And all, of course, there's all the old credit standbys of, you know, get a gas station credit card, buy something on time payments at a local merchant. Those are ways that get some credit built up, although it's going to be, you know, a slower road with that kind of thing. But these are all strategies that you can start using if you're going to be responsible. If you are going to add a kid as an authorized signer and say, this card is just for emergencies or this card is just for textbooks, you know, make that clear. And the fact that an emergency doesn't involve anything you know, eat, drink, or wear.
As a matter of fact, one I remember with my friend and her son and his credit cards were all the McDonald's charges that he had racked up over time. So bottom line, is the fact that 63% of millennials do not have credit cards, is that a good for them or an uh-oh story?
I think it's a little bit of both. In a lot of cases, it's not even just, it's an uh-oh, but it's an uh-oh for us in the case of, you know, kids who are staggering under these ridiculous student debt loads with toxic debt that you can't get out of even in bankruptcy. And that really needs to be addressed. We see that they're not buying cars because they have too much debt. They're not getting married because they have too much debt. They're not forming households. Doesn't matter if they can't get a mortgage because they have no credit history. They're not going to buy a house and get married anyway. And so that's the downside of it. The upside is that many of them are doing it because they do want to be responsible, and they need to learn that, you know, the downside to that is a simple thing to do, is to just start getting engaged responsibly, you know, with credit so that you can build that credit history. The other thing is that a lot of times, especially to work in a financial services industry or a lot of employers or to rent an apartment, you need a credit history. Another piece of good news is that there are several alternative credit scores that are being developed that will be more friendly to people with limited credit histories, so that it will start to track things like utility payments and rent payments, which normally aren't part of your credit history. If you're paying your electric bill and your phone bill on time in your campus apartment, that usually doesn't count towards your credit report. But there are some alternate credit scores that have been developed that will track that. They aren't widely used at this point, but I think at some point the credit industry is gonna wise up and say, you know, these kids are out there. When they do get jobs, we want to start building that relationship with them, and so we're going to start considering these sort of alternative credit scores that will capture, you know, their more accurate payment history.
Brian O'Connor is a Detroit News personal finance columnist. Always good to talk with you, Brian. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
It's the animal byproduct you probably haven't thought of, if you think of animal byproducts. Ambergris. Through the centuries, it's been used in perfumes, even as a flavoring for food and as an aphrodisiac. It's one of the world's most expensive substances. Pretty glamorous, particularly when you consider that ambergris is whale poop. Christopher Kemp is a molecular biologist at Michigan State University. He's written a book about ambergris called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. Chris, very good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
You know, there cannot be very many experts on whale poop out there. How did an MSU molecular biologist decide that he wanted to join their ranks?
Well, I think it was an accident. It was an accidental thing, to tell you the truth. I was working in New Zealand at a university there, and I switched the news on one night, and there was this segment on the news about this object that had washed ashore on the coastline near Wellington, which is sort of a major metropolitan city. And so, you know, there's lots of people jogging along the waterfront. And no one knew what it was. But at some point, someone suggested maybe it was ambergris. And suddenly, hundreds of people st- stormed the beach and hacked the object to pieces and took some of it home, thinking that they had struck it rich. And I was just flabbergasted and watched this and thought, well, what is ambergris? And why are people so crazy for it? And so that's really where my journey began, from sort of complete ignorance to somehow becoming one of the few people in the world who knows a lot about ambergris, and that's how the book was born, really.
Well, Chris, you are crystal clear in your book that ambergris isn't whale vomit. It's not the whale equivalent of a hairball. It is sperm whale poop, and no matter what anyone out there thinks they know about it, that's it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's right. It, you know, throughout history, you know, there's documents that go back to the 16 and 1700s, and there's always been this confusion about where ambergris comes from and how it's made. And scientists used to say that it was like a mushroom that grew on the bottom of the ocean and was dislodged in a storm, and now they say that it's vomit that is sort of coughed up or spat up by a whale, and you know, that still lingers, that confusion, but all of the scientific literature would suggest that it's actually made in the hind gut and is ejected out like poop. And you know, anyone who's had the fortune or misfortune to hold a lump of fresh, black, sticky ambergris would have no confusion, because it really smells fecal and dungy and poopy, really. I mean, it's like holding a fresh sheep dung in your hand.
Not lovely. And so how did this, you know, fecally smelling, dungy stuff wind up becoming part of the perfumer's art for so many centuries?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. One is that over time, that fecal, dungy, nasty smell sort of changes and transforms and matures and becomes something much different and much more sort of like in some of the best perfumes, you have this musky sort of animalic, aggressive scent that sort of holds all the lighter tones together. And so that's what it does. You know, it's essential to have sort of a bit of the gross with a bit of the nice. But the other thing is that chemically it has some really important components to it. It's very sort of fatty and cholesterol-rich and non-volatile. And so what that means is that it binds to the fragrance compounds and it makes them last a lot longer on the wearer's skin. And so in addition to having its own sort of fragrance components, it actually stabilizes the perfume and makes it last a lot longer.
Now, we know ambergris has been largely replaced by a synthetic in perfumes today. Do you think there are any scents out there today that actually include the real thing?
Well, there definitely are. Yeah, I mean, there's a move in the perfume industry toward artisanal perfumes that people sort of build one sort of component at a time, and there are people that are making huge sums of money by designing these bespoke perfumes for people who have enough money, and that they definitely have ambergris in them if the customer wants it. But then there's also this sort of mystery that's central to the book that I don't know that I ever really adequately answered, which is, are companies like Chanel still using ambergris in their fragrances too? And all the evidence would suggest that they are. You know, I spoke with ambergris dealers who live in the south of France and who are willing to fly to the Maldives or the Philippines or India to buy ambergris from people who find it. And they're the sort of people who aren't really willing to get out of bed for anything less than a big 50-pound boulder of the stuff. Uh-huh. And so clearly there's a market for it. And they were willing to tell me that through middlemen and these shady clandestine folks that they sell it to Chanel and Guerlain and some of the biggest French perfumers. And so definitely, there's still a market for it, and it's definitely still being used in some aspects of fragrance.
And it sounds, from what you're saying, as if it's very very precious and very costly.
Well, that's right. You know, it's even though there are synthetic versions of it, it's you know, I always say it's like the difference between watching the Beatles and watching a cover band of the Beatles. You know, I mean, you could have a bunch of guys who can do the hits just fine, but there's something almost indefinable that's missing that you can't quite put your finger on. And so the lab can get close to it, but it can't quite get anywhere near the authentic thing. And, you know, it's just an extremely unusual substance that has to have a whole bunch of different requirements to be made, and so that's where the cost comes in.
And it is illegal, am I correct, to buy and sell ambergris in the U.S.?
In the U.S., it is illegal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972. In other countries, it's totally legal to trade and to buy and sell it. Here in the U.S., it is technically illegal, but there still seems to be a market for it because that trade doesn't seem to be very well enforced.
Well, I just thought I would see while I was kind of getting ready to talk to you, and I typed in ambergris on eBay, and all kinds of offerings came up, but I guess it's hard to know if that's the real deal or not, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to do, to try and buy or sell it online, because you may just be getting actual poop instead of ambergris.
What do you hope people will get out of reading Floating Gold?
Well, you know, I think that just fundamentally the idea of ambergris, it sort of gets to the whole mystery of the ocean. You know, I mean, it's still one of the most unexplored regions of the world. Still more people have walked on the moon than have walked on the bottom of the deepest parts of the ocean. And, you know, I think it's sort of a universal thing that we all at some point have walked along the coastline somewhere and seen something that we just don't know what it is. And I want people to now sort of revisit that moment in their memory and say, maybe it was ambergris. You know, maybe I gave sort of an exploratory kick to a lump of ambergris that was worth $100,000 and then just shrugged and walked on instead.
Fascinating. Michigan State University molecular biologist Christopher Kemp. His book on ambergris is called Floating Gold. And next time we're on beaches, I think we'll be all looking eyes down to see if we can see some ambergris. But I think the chances of that are pretty slim to none, aren't they?
Slim, but not none.
Fair enough. Christopher, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks.
There are over 200,000 disconnected youth in Michigan. Young people who aren't in school and they're not working either. How did they end up on the fringes? And how do we help them reconnect with our economy and our communities? Join us tomorrow for a special State of Opportunity call-in program as we explore how to help disconnected youth. That's tomorrow afternoon at 3, right here on Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.